The views expressed in the podcast you are about to listen to are the opinions of the presenter and the cast. None of us are official representatives of the companies we work for, and we are in no way responsible for what we say. If you are offended or otherwise afflicted by these opinions, please push the unsubscribe button in iTunes and go do something else.
My little darling, it is love at first sight, is it not? No? No, boy. I'm happy. Why are you always shaking your eye?
The animation conversation.
Okay, are we all recording?
Yep, I'm on 62%.
Good. So, what 62% power?
energy levels. Energy,
well, okay, I see. Your personal energy.
62%.
Get some sugar.
I've had a mince pie.
Shouldn't we have a bottle of tequila each to pass between
us? We absolutely should. But I have some wine. I saw you have some girly
cider. Yeah.
Cider.
And yeah. What are you drinking, Will?
I've just had a glass of port and a mince pie, but
that's so grown up.
Yeah.
Wow, you're like 80 years old suddenly.
Yeah. The last one of these we did, we were passing a bottle of tequila between the four of us.
Okay. You know what? Yeah. Dave King, next time we're gonna drink some more tequila. That's Tequila Talks 2.0. It's gonna happen next time. I have a bottle of tequila. Do you have a bottle of tequila, Will?
I do, yeah. I have to.
Perfect,
yeah.
Perfect.
Oh, nice.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, that's my favorite whiskey.
This is what I keep in my office at work.
Yeah, Dave King is showing us some Havana Club rum and some other stuff that I've never seen before. And that marks the beginning of the ACP podcast number 81, I think it is, for Tuesday, December 15th. 2015, we're really back in it, right? This is fun.
Yeah, good to have you back.
Thank you.
I've missed
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, it's good to have you on the show.
So much fun. So it's just us three, and we're normally three, but we should there should be one more person there, and that's Morten, but he's not here this week.
No. We miss you, Morten.
Yeah,
we definitely miss you, and he'll be back in a few weeks for sure.
Yeah.
Today we have the as always amazing Dave King. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Yeah, I did.
You did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I just my brain just was like I had a brain fart, and my brain was like, just say Dame Edna or something?
It's not a difficult name. That's the great thing about my name, you know.
No, exactly.
It's two lots of four letters, Dave King.
Yeah, but it's late in the evening and we're all tired.
It is. Yeah, it's been a very long week today.
Oh, yeah. Has it been a very long week, Dave King? What have you been doing in the last few? in the last 5 years since we last talked to you?
I've put on some weight, lost some hair. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah, that's all I've done really.
Because I remember when we talked to you last time, you were just starting teaching at the Volda Animation School.
Yep.
And you hadn't started your company yet, had you?
Nope, that was not in existence at all. So much has happened in 5 years. It's kind of insane.
Maybe we can start talking a little bit about the company, because I thought that was just a great idea.
Yeah, sure. Rain Dog Studios. Which I think we talked a little bit the last time we did one of these casts. I think we talked a little bit about our plans at Hog School and Ivolda to sort of establish a more slightly more commercially minded course of doing projects that actively involved students in the real world. And we did that actually very soon after I talked with you guys. We started off a big project that it was for a client, a big shipyard, one of the big shipyards up here on the west coast, Cleven Maritime. and they needed some health and safety films making. They had a huge workforce that many of people who don't speak English or don't speak Norwegian speak lots of different languages, and so they needed some health and safety films that kind of overcame the language barrier. And so animation was decided to be the perfect medium to do that. And so I pitched an idea for a series of these short movies involving a sort of a core group of three central characters. And we had a group of students here, seven students. And with those, they became my animation team on the project. And so we made two pilot short films for Cleven. And they were just knocked out of the park. They were so impressed with these two films that they sort of ordered another, I think it was another 12 films or something like that. And and so at that point, I turned around to the guys that I'd been working with, and I said, you know, actually, we have something quite interesting here. We seem to be working together very well. And maybe we should do something with it. And so actually we set up a company. So it's seven of my ex-students and myself. And we set up Rain Dog Studios in the spring. I think we really began in the spring, summer of 2011, I guess it would have been. And the company is going great guns. We're now split across we have offices in two different towns. We're still based here in Volda. And we also have a main office now where I think three or four of the guys are in Bergen.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was sort of like the studio was a part of the school, like it was some sort of a collaborative thing. But now you actually have a company that you're working in a company you're head of the studio.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I'm creative director in the studio. And I mean, the idea of this course was literally to do what happened, which was for students to, you know, work with clients, work to real-time deadlines, work with budgets, understand how a real job works. And the hope was that the students who went on these courses would then go out and sort of maybe set their own companies up. What we didn't expect was that I would be involved in the first company. And so now I split my time between the school and Rain Dog. It's a big juggling job, imagine. Especially because I have other things on the go as well, which we can talk about later. But obviously, you know, the school and Rain Dog, we've run other courses like that since then, and they've always been very successful. We did a big stop motion project, actually, for another of the big maritime companies up here, Allstein.
Is this the school or is this?
This was at the school. Yeah. Another course that was run in exactly the same way. And the Allstein shipyards wanted to produce a kind of water cooler talk piece for the company. The kind of animation that, you know, I mean, if anybody from Allstein is listening to this, I'm sure they won't mind me saying that the kind of work that they generally turn out in terms of their animated promotional films is very much of a type. It's beautiful, slick CGI shots of you know, their latest ship sailing majestically down the fjord. It's you know, it's always beautifully done and everything, but Allstein recognized that they wanted something different, something that people would talk about. And so we got the students to pitch various concepts to them, and the one that they eventually went with was an homage to the old 1930s black and white Universal Frankenstein movies. And so the you know, it's the first thing you think about when you think of shipyards. And so this commercial was made, and it's just beautiful. It's black and white, and we made huge sets for it, and we had a very talented one of our Erasmus exchange students from France actually headed up the team and directed the film, Marie Le Chevalier. And she did a beautiful job on this short film, which you can find on Vimeo and YouTube. It's called Frank Ulstein. And it really is. It's a beautiful play on the old Frankenstein films. There's lots of, you know, electric machinery sparking off everywhere. And we were very fortunate. I managed to track down the rights owner to the guy that composed the music score for The Bride of Frankenstein in 1934, I think. It was a guy called Franz Waxman, and I managed to track down his son in Hollywood, who then got me in contact with the rights owners for the score to The Bride of Frankenstein. Actually it was through Universal Records, but it was actually a company in England called Silver Screen Records. Mm-hmm. And they gave us permission to use clips from Franz Waxman's original score for The Bride of Frankenstein. So it makes the film, it makes it incredibly authentic sounding. If you know The Bride of Frankenstein, it's a very whimsical horror movie, a very camp horror movie.
I don't know if I've even seen that. Have you seen it, Will?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It's beautiful. It's one of the greatest horror movies ever made.
And I've seen the short film as well. So it's,
A great. I mean, James Whale, the director, was a gay guy in Hollywood in the 1930s, and it's an incredible talk piece. The Bride of Frankenstein is an incredible talk piece about being gay at that period of time. That there's so much gay subtext to be read into it, that it's kind of it's done outrageously. You watch it now and you kind of can't believe what Whale was pushing through onto audiences. It's incredibly smart film, a very funny film, with a really lovely dark sort of twisted sense of horror. And so we were really lucky to get the use of the score for this commercial that we did for Ulstein. And in fact, the director, Marie, went over to England, and she has just literally finished a kind of internship with Aardman Animation. And we've just had an email from her this week, Andres Mand and I, Andres being the head of the course here at Volda. We had an email from Marie saying that she's just been offered a job on Nick Park's new feature film.
Excellent.
So we're having a really good, successful run with these projects that I mentioned to you before about, you know, helping to get students out into the world. It's obviously succeeding.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just with Boulder, you know, Got Milk, you know, is that the right title? Yeah, I mean, that was...
But Milk is important.
That was one of the most shown short films of the last few years.
Yeah, it's won huge amounts of awards at festivals all around the world. I mean, obviously, there's a long history of students doing well from Volda.
We all work with them.
Yeah,
all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, most of them. I mean, as I understand it, a huge section of the new Floor Clipper film is made up of ex-Volda students. So we're very proud of that. But it's also in the last 5 years since I've been here, we have made a much more concerted effort at taking on projects that would see the students engaged in employment in the world beyond education.
Yeah,
it's fun now that you can see it.
It's so much fun now that you can that they're actually stop motion in films being produced in Norway, so these people can go
absolutely
and work with stop motion in Norway, because that didn't happen just 5 years ago.
No,
you know?
It's really, really cool. I mean, it's so great. It's lovely to see that there is a real surge forward in animation in general in Norway.
Yeah.
It's
and Kvisten is in the center of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've got Kvisten and Bug and Microfilm and Rain Dog, and you know, everybody seems to be pretty busy and doing stuff, and it's interesting. But if you turn on Norwegian TV, there's so much animation on TV. It's astonishing. Advertising using animation now is just non-stop.
Oh yeah. But it's usually made in CG and made look like stop motion.
Yeah.
I don't think the Nidar stuff that's going on TV. That's actually animated using stop motion, isn't it?
Okay. Is it? The Nidar stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Animation department did that.
Right. Yeah, they're good guys as well. Actually, they do some really nice work. Yeah.
Kevin Walton animated that. So,
okay.
But it's not made in CG?
No. It was all stop motion, and Kevin is...
it's pretty great.
Sadly, he passed away last year, but he's... He worked at, Leica and Aardman, directed Pengu, but he worked over here in Norway a lot.
Okay.
And, so he worked for animations department.
Yep. What was his name?
Kevin Walton.
Kevin Walton, okay. Yeah. Sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, so... Yeah,
it's a tough life in the animation industry.
We all have
a fairly low life expectancy, let's face it, you know.
Yes,
we do. And Frank and Ollie, they were like 95 when they died, right?
I'm surprised I've lasted 5 years here since talking to you guys, you know.
Yeah.
I've been to Boulder and I'm surprised.
Is there a lot of partying going on in Volda these days?
Oh, I'm too old for that kind of thing now.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I'm sure you are.
Yeah. There is, but I don't hear about it, you know.
Well, my experience was as this lonely lorry driver who wanted somewhere to go.
I can't complain at that, Will. The lonely lorry driver randomly bought us an entire round of drinks.
I know, yeah. It was at the Twilight Zone afterwards.
It was.
Though.
It really was.
Should I have been there?
You definitely should have been there. You might have gotten very well with this lonely lorry driver. He'd been parked up in some ice fjord somewhere for 6 months, surviving only on the flesh of whatever he caught, you know, whatever passed by, I think.
Yeah.
And then he found himself in Volder and he was desperate to party with anyone.
Yeah.
We seemed like a likely prospect, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
We seemed game. he had very cold hands. That's all I remember.
I'm not even going to ask how you know that. Because I certainly never found out he had cold hands.
Why would you know that, Will?
long story, but he got very comfortable with me.
Yeah, let's skip that story.
Yeah.
I think I need to hear that story at some point, actually. Maybe off the air.
Point. Yeah, somewhere more private. We had a couple of things we wanted to talk about. Should we skip that, or do we want to talk about these commercials, Will?
No. It was something, a point of interest, but since we have Dave King...
It was a bit interesting, Dave, you got to see a couple of them, or one of them, right?
Yeah, I watched one of them. We're talking
the
about the Mog commercials for Sainsbury's in the UK.
Do you know this character from before? Or?
I'm kind of vaguely aware of it, but, you know, I'm some...
I do.
I'm not an animal person. I'm certainly not a cat person.
Okay.
I'm one of these people who gets fed up to the eye teeth of my Facebook feed being full of humorous, and I'm doing the inverted comma sign as I say this, humorous cat videos, you know. I have so many people on my friends list who are just obsessed with cats.
Cats are cute. I have a few cats, so I'm not going to chime in on this. I actually have three of them. But I do have two dogs too.
I guess I just kind of react now when anybody says, "Oh, look at the funny cat video commercial." You know, I have this kind of alarm system go off in my inner monologue.
Yeah. But I have the same thing with kids, you know.
Yeah, those bloody children.
The worst
so
thing
annoying.
Is when people change their Facebook profile picture to a picture of their kid. That makes me like tear up my head. You know, I don't have any head hair yet, so. You know how that happened.
Hang on a minute.
But I guess I was kind of aware of Mog, vaguely. It was.
Oh, it comes from Judith Kerr.
Judith Kerr, yeah.
I think she's 205 now.
I was watching the making of video, and she looked very cute when she was younger. That's probably a very un-PC thing to say, but. But she did, yeah. and she was still alive in the video, so that's nice for her.
Let's talk about the animation, because I think the compositing and how the character looked and everything, it seemed like they didn't have enough time to make that cat look just perfect.
I felt the same thing.
But
it looks very much like the illustrations.
And, yeah, did you like just like the movements? Did you like the animation or?
No, I didn't. I'm really sorry because it's probably people I know back in the UK because it's Framestore, and I recently got into trouble on Facebook for lambasting the. Which company is it that did the one with? Is it maybe it's John Lewis, where they do the Christmas commercial this year of the wee smelling old guy on the moon with his granddaughter looking up at him through the telescope, and I started lambasting it on Facebook, sort of saying how dreadfully mawkish I thought it was, and suddenly a friend of mine cropped up saying, "Oh, you know I worked on that, don't you?" And I was like, "Oh,
oops."
You know,
so the odds is you probably know someone who worked on this ad too, right?
Possibly.
Oh yeah, probably. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I think they probably did a fine job on it, but I had some problem with the character design because I think they tried to make it look like the original drawings, which are very like childish or not childish, but they're
scratchy,
very simple.
But
then they wanted to make it realistic because it's supposed to fit into this full realistic.
It was like Garfield a few years ago.
Yeah, that's Garfield was exactly what I was thinking of. It's one of those ghastly fucking things where they can't make their minds up whether it's live action or CG or whatever it is, and it ends up falling into this bizarre
blob
like in between world. I'm really sorry people at Framestore,
I'm thinking I would have the same issues, like if I was assigned this task to make this character and make this transition, I think I would have the same problems, and I would say like, okay, you want to make this thing, and I'm can't guarantee that it's going to be something worthwhile, but let's try.
It's lethal when you just film it against like a live action background. I mean, at least the backgrounds need to be stylized in some way. It could still be live action, but I think you have to stylize the art direction needs to
maybe make it less messy, you know, because then you could make the cat less messy and have it a little less. Realistic.
Having said that, Framestore did Paddington Bear last year, which worked well because he was as you know, you said he did look like a bear, but he was talking, but he suited the universe.
They certainly had like 10 times the budget on making that character,
though I can't imagine this Sainsbury's ad would have been
cheap,
dirt cheap, not their kind of. You know,
it's not cheap, but
I'm
like the salaries are bigger and the time frame is a lot smaller. So it's like you have to push all this creativity into just a few months of work, and it doesn't turn out as well as if you do a full feature thing where you develop the characters through 3 or 4 years.
No, I mean, good luck to them. You know, if it's successful, fantastic, and they'll get plenty of Promax awards and blah, 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 whatever. But for me, artistically, it was pretty unsatisfying, I think.
But there's this horrible trend in the UK at the moment of these really saccharine, sweet Christmas adverts, trying to make everyone cry all the time. And this Spanish one which was released. Did you see that one?
No. What was this one?
It's a lottery. It's really advert. Beautiful.
It's a really nice film. It's really well. It's everything. It's what we. It's sort of the ante of the Mog the Cat.
Right.
It's very inspired by Up, the character design.
And it's actual Pixar quality, isn't it? It's like
Spanish.
When you see it's perfect. There's nothing I could say about it that's like negative, except for that I didn't quite understand the story.
No, I've watched it a few times. I still don't know what's going on. But
no,
and I
look at all the comments and everyone is saying like, oh, I can't stop crying after watching this commercial.
Oh, that's like,
what? I will not cry, says a couple of her.
I'm just happy they use the medium of animation to do these stuff. So it's I'm just happy with that.
Because you can be more sentimental in animation without,
I think sentimental is fine. You know, I mean, Toy Story and you know, the Pixar are very good at finding that balance between sentimentality and not tipping over into mawkishness. Yeah. Yeah. So it can be done, but you know, certainly the John Lewis advert this year is that's the one with the kid in the balloons, and there's a great Star Wars
I've seen that one, the parody,
which is very funny, with Darth Vader. I think is it Darth Vader on the moon or something?
Yeah, it is.
It's very well done.
Okay, should we just put this on the shelves for this year and let's talk about something else that I wanted to. Since I have you here, and I think you've mentioned Darth Vader, his name, right?
Oh no, but wait a minute. what about Dave is making a huge film?
What?
Or can you not talk about that?
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's all gone public now, so it's
Let's talk about that, and then we'll talk about Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, it's another one of the projects. Along the line of this concerted effort to involve students more in practical animation and filmmaking, we've run a few IP courses over the years. We've run two so far. And you're going to ask me what an IP course means, and it's just gone out of my head. It's intensive program.
Oh, not intellectual property.
No, it's a different kind of IP. It's an intensive program. And the first one we ran was called Acting for Animators. And then the second one we ran was called What's Up After Uni. And what these courses are, they're a collaboration between different institutions. So, for example, the What's Up After Uni one was a collaboration between Hogg School in Evolda, University of Glamorgan, although I think it's now called University of South Wales, if I remember rightly, Thomas Butter University in Zlin in the Czech Republic, and it might have been the Estonian Art Academy. But they're basically done as partnerships, and it's an intensive 2-week course that students from each of the partner universities get to attend. And for example, the What's Up After Uni one was 2 weeks of essentially learning how to pitch ideas, how to formulate and pitch ideas. In the first week, they would go to each year it was run at a different one of the partner countries. So it would be, you know, hosted in Norway 1 year, in Czech Republic another year, in Wales another year. And a group of students from each of the universities would be picked, and they'd go on the course, and they would spend a week. First of all, traveling around studios in whatever town or city they're in, going to meet people in the industry and sort of getting themselves inspired. And then the second week would be they would actually pitch from – they would be split into groups, and then they would go through the process of pitching a series of commercials. So a whole campaign of they in a week they had to come up with a campaign, and then at the end of the week they would do a visual pitch of what the whole campaign was, including animatics for one or more of the commercials that they were going to do. And so these IP courses, they're intensive training courses. But we had run the first two courses for as long as we could run them. EU rules state that you can only run them for, I think it's 3 years or something. And so we decided to come up with a brand new course and to pitch that to the EU, to make an application to the EU to get it running. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the first year, we failed. The application has to, obviously, it has to involve all of the partner universities, and these applications are like 60 pages thick. Yeah. And we failed the first time round.
I think you're supposed to fail a couple of times.
I think it was. You know, it teaches us humility.
Yeah, common practice in Norway to let you fail a couple of times before they give you the
I think you have to
money.
Get. So I can't remember what it is. You have to get like a minimum of 59 points or something, and I think we got 52 points or something like that. But anyway, actually was a good thing, because we decided to apply again, and we made a much, much stronger application. So now it will involve it's three different universities. It's Bournemouth Arts University. It's Arts University Bournemouth, Hogeschool and Ivolda, and Thomas Butter in Zlin. But it will also involve production companies. So my own company, Rain Dog, is involved in Norway. Passion Pictures, which is one of the biggest production houses in the world, they've also agreed to support the project. Cool. And we have a Czech post-production company, Kuzena Productions, who will be involved in it. And the idea of the course this time, it's called Euro Anime. And so the idea is to, in the first instance, it's a research project, and we will travel to Japan to meet with Japanese animation studios. And we want to learn about their production pipelines. You know, obviously the Japanese are very successful with animation as a medium. Yeah. And yet they don't have the kind of budgets that, say, America has for a lot of their projects. So we want to try and find out in the first instance, is there a reason for this? Is it something to do with the production techniques that they use? Is it the pipeline techniques? Is it just something cultural? We don't know. And so the first part of the project is a research project to try and find out.
Mm. That's very interesting, because, you know, the car factories in – have you heard about this?
Yep.
In what's the place in the US where they make all the cars?
Detroit.
The Detroit factories. They had a project going with some Mitsubishi or Toyota or something.
Yep.
Where they traveled to China, and they were trying to teach, like, find out how the Japanese or wherever they are. Taiwanese, where are they?
Chinese,
yeah. Chinese, maybe manufacturers were doing how they could make such great cars.
Yeah,
in
Japanese.
Yeah.
I'm
not going to say it's all the same.
Know, but... I mean, we're not sure there is a difference that could be applied to, you know, Western Europe production techniques. We're not sure, and so that is part of the research project is to find that out. The second part of the project will actually involve taking students from each of the courses, and we have come up with a storyline for a feature film, a potential feature film, which I've written with friend of mine who's working as the producer on this project, a guy called Andy Frain from the UK. And
Andy Frain?
Andy Frain, yeah.
Who sounds like Andy Dufresne.
Nope,
someone else.
No, it's someone who looks like who is it? Who's he's always getting who was the guy in Love Actually, the English guy?
Hugh Grant?
No, not Hugh Grant. Along those lines, it's the English guy, the one who was in the Sense and Sensibility, who came out of the water with his wet shirt on.
That was Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
And that was Colin Firth. Yeah.
Colin Firth, yes, yes. Yeah. And Andy looks like Colin Firth. He's always getting mistaken for Colin Firth. And he'll kill me if he hears this podcast now for saying that. But he's the producer on this project with me. And so we've come up with an idea for a story for a feature film.
Based on Japanese anime or...
No, not at all. That's the thing about this. It's not anime in style at all. All that we want to do is learn about their production techniques. So, however, the storyline will involve cross-cultural shenanigans. It is a road movie of sorts, which is probably about as much as I can and say about it at the moment. But it is a kind of road movie.
Can you say what you've been inspired by? Giving too much away?
Where's my car?
Where's my car? Is actually that's my inspiration for everything, really.
It is a good movie.
Excuse me. I've got to say my personal inspiration is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Okay.
I'm a huge Hunter S. Thompson fanatic.
Already looking forward to this.
We haven't quite nailed the tone of it yet, but we know that it's not going to be a kids' film.
Okay.
So it's a slightly. I think we're going to aim it at a slightly older. We're not going after the Disney Pixar age range with it at all. But so the idea is that we will do a series of courses that determines which students get to work as the animation team that will make the trailer, the pitch trailer for this film, and then we will attempt to get the trailer to be pitched at Cartoon Movie Forum in Lyon in 2018, I think it is. Yeah, 2018. So yeah. It's a sort of 2.5 year project. And we got awarded just over £1 million by the EU, which sounds like a lot of money, but actually
that's not enough.
No, it's not.
No.
I mean, we are looking at ways of bringing other funding into the project now. But it's
crowdfunding, maybe.
Which funding?
Crowdfunding?
Probably not at this stage. I think it's maybe too difficult to get that involved as an educational, because this is, at the end of the day, it's an educational project for the students involved in. So there might be issues with that, but we're looking at ways of bringing other funding in for it. We've just had our first summit meeting in London of all the partners involved in this, because obviously there's a lot of partners involved in this, like sort of seven or eight partner institutions. And so we all met up at a central London hotel a couple of weekends ago and began to sort of thrash out the practicalities of this project. And it is a huge project. It's going to take a large chunk of my time over the next 2 years. And then obviously if we pitch it at Cartoon Movie, if we happen to be successful, and obviously that's a huge if.
That's a given, I'm saying.
Wow, I'm not going to. You might say that. I couldn't possibly say that. But if we were successful and we got funding at Cartoon Movie to actually make the feature, then of course that's a whole other kettle of fish there, and we have to sort of see what happens from there. But I know that Andy as the producer and myself as the sort of script writer and director would be keen to follow the project through. So we'll see what happens. But it's a very exciting project for the students, because they really will get to work in, you know, animation teams, and they'll get to set their own teams up. And they'll be working in different countries, so we'll use, you know, cloud technology to pass, you know, footage back and forth between the different teams, and
which is how productions are done now. I mean, the last few things I've directed on or worked on.
Absolutely.
That's what we've done.
Yeah, really? You did that. You did that big project, Will, where you were traveling to, was it Iceland,
London, yeah, back and forth. Yeah. And you know, but nothing was actually produced in Norway. So it was
it's increasingly the way that projects are pulled together these days, you know.
Yeah,
so
because you get funding from all sorts of governments and subsidiaries,
absolutely,
tax incentives from all different countries.
No, it just really it makes sense not to travel with planes back and forth throughout Europe for just a couple of meetings. You know,
absolutely.
We have this great thing called the internet, and we have Skype, and
which we ourselves
thing.
Are using at the moment. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I've talked to people like, should we take a meeting over Skype? And they say maybe we should just take a plane and meet up. But let's just try Skype first and see if that works. And
there is this odd fear of, you know, doing what we're doing here of Skype. Yeah. You know,
and we're actually seeing you're not seeing it while you're listening to this, but we are actually seeing each other's faces, and you can react, and you can show your drawings, and you can actually share your screen. It's pretty easy to work.
Listeners, three of us are actually naked while we're recording this, because we're incredibly comfortable with each other, and we discussed it off air before we began, and said should we be naked for this? And everybody
I'm gonna put down the time for when we start talking about this, because we usually cut out that part. That's a well-kept secret. No one needs to know. 81 episodes and you had to go and blur it out. It's like
I've got makeup on this week as well.
But the most interesting thing about this episode is to watch Will. You started at the top of the screen, and now you're halfway through the bottom of the screen.
Oh, yeah.
You can barely see your glasses.
Oh, really?
I'm hoping we'll just be talking to his hair by the end of the episode.
I've actually worked with Will on we worked on a couple of movies together, and Will was always sitting like he was about to fall asleep. It was just like leaning down in his chair, like
horizontal,
with his legs straight out.
It's a really useful trick. I've pulled it myself, you know.
And the amazing thing is that Will is the only one I know that doesn't have back problems.
There's a lot to be said for slouching, you know, creative slouching in the right place.
I do have back problems now, but
good.
Just after tonight, they just started tonight.
Okay.
It was ever since I met that man with cold hands in Boulder. Mm-hmm.
Boulder has so much to answer for, let me tell you.
Yeah, you need to have warm hands when you're doing that back rub.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it wasn't really a rub.
It was more like a stroke, wasn't it? It was a gentle stroke. That's what I
more
saw.
Like a rub out. Let's talk a little bit about Star Wars, because you know, we have a big fan here, and we're all sort of fans, like. Yep. Right, Will? You've seen a few of them.
Yes, yeah. And then I know Dave had this thing in Boulder, didn't you? Your collection was out.
Yeah. I mean, that was amazing. That's another thing that has sprung into life in the last 5 years is the Norsk Animation Centrum, or the Norwegian Animation Centrum here in Boulder. That came out of a... I began a conversation with people locally, sort of saying that obviously Oslo is the heart of the Norwegian animation industry in Norway. It's where, you know, most of the big companies are, and like any capital city, it's where you know, much of the business migrates to. But Volda has this really odd, unique place in Norwegian animation, because a lot of the Norwegian animation industry studied here. Huge swathes of the Norwegian animation industry started their careers here in Volda. And obviously we have the longest running animation course in Norway. Originally
began festival.
We have the yearly animation festival, so I began this conversation locally with people as a way of kind of saying, you know, maybe there are lots of issues in Volda about sort of getting tourists here and whether the tourist industry could be built up here. And one of the things that I said was that if that were going to happen, that animation should play a big part in that, because, you know, we had several animation companies working here, and we have the, you know, the animation festival and the animation course. And so I said, you know, maybe we should rebrand Volda as the heart of Norwegian animation. This was the original idea. Mm-hmm. And from this kind of talk about what could we do here in Volda to celebrate this fact, Andres actually turned around and said, you know, maybe we could do like an animation museum or something like that. And so the idea kickstarted up from these two things that we were talking about. And it was coming towards an Animation Volda festival, I think, in 2012, maybe. And we decided to try and create a little animation center, an animation gallery, stroke museum, stroke archive. And it was all put together on a very, very ad hoc basis. It was done with hardly any money involved, and originally it was put together in the basement of there's a place here called the Sunnmøre Kultur Næringshage, which is where a lot of local companies sort of, it's like an incubator building where a lot of local companies begin. It's actually where Raindog started up. That we had our first office there. And so we had this little animation gallery in the basement of this, and we had it there for a year or so, and then we decided to expand it and move it to a shopfront in the town centre. And so now we have an actual.
You decided to move it, or like how did you get that working out?
We decided that we were beginning to be taken a little bit more seriously. We had had conversations with the Norsk Film Institute came up to see us, and they were very excited about the idea of us eventually becoming an archive for Norwegian animation materials.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, which is really exciting. I mean, we're not quite at the stage where we can do that yet. We've begun to do it on a more small scale basis by taking in props and original artwork.
Collecting.
It's part of a much larger plan here in Volda. The Hogskolen is planning to build a new media building in the next 3 to 5 years. It's been suggested that we can have actual archive space in the new media building for the Norwegian Animation Center. So we will actually be able to properly archive material here that, you know, obviously props and sets and design material. It's always a problem for studios as to, particularly with puppet animation, as to what they do with the material. What do we do with these beautiful sets? So what we are hoping to become is the primary archive center for all of Norwegian animation materials.
Brilliant.
And so what we felt was, the reason that we moved to the new gallery space is that we felt that we wanted to establish genuinely our own space, so that essentially so that we would be taken more seriously as an institution. So we, I mean, it's still the funding for it. We're supported, thankfully, we're supported very much by Hog School in Evolda. But the funding is still very, you know, it's very much hand to mouth. But we've managed to keep it surviving for, I guess, 3 years now. And
Volta, the school, is paying for the storefront.
They put some funds towards the cost of the store, you know, the rental that we pay for the store. And they help us out in other ways as well. They've been the original dean, Sveta Listol, was incredibly supportive of the animation center, and now the new dean, Paul Om, is also thankfully very supportive of it. We get a lot of support from the guys at Hog School and Evolda. So, but it's very much a, you know, the plan for the Norwegian Animation Center is very much a long term thing, and that's why we recognize, you know, we can't do everything and be everything that we want to be already, as much as we'd like to be. You know, it's going to take us time to build this thing up, and also to get the Norwegian animation industry to actually understand that we will have proper archive space here, where, you know, where the material will be, you know, temperature controlled and light controlled, and we can look after it. So again, you know, this is just another one of the billion and one projects that goes on up here. But to answer the question, to get back to the Star Wars thing, we've had some. I mean, this is the long and winding road. You know, when you invite me onto a cast like this, you know, I'm gonna.
And he hasn't had tequila either.
So
and he hasn't had tequila either.
Exactly, yeah. Just a little bit of cider, you know.
No, but so this is very interesting stuff, and we have to like go through all of these things one by one.
Yeah. So we've done some really cool exhibitions there. We've had Norman McLaren. We had some original works by Norman McLaren in the exhibition for him. We've had we did an exhibition on Bob Godfrey. It was called The Two Bobs, and it was actually an exhibition celebrating the British animator Bob Godfrey, who is actually known as the godfather of Norwegian animation.
Yes.
And obviously he had a lot to do with Norwegian animation and a lot to do with Volda. He came over to Volda when the course was just being started in the very early days, and had a lot of connections with Gunnar Ström, who is of course,
I've seen,
you know,
some pictures.
Yeah,
with a young Gunnar Ström in the on the side there,
And so Bob was like a huge supporter of Norwegian animation, and we got friendly with Godfrey's grandson, a guy called Tom Lowe, who I believe you two have met.
Yeah, I mean,
Tom.
I'm investing in his new film.
Yeah,
so,
great guy.
I'm investing in his new film.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Tom came over here a few years ago now to Volda, and we began to talk about doing an exhibition with Bob, and so we did this one that celebrated Bob Godfrey and also one of his musical collaborators, a guy called
Bob Marley.
Bob Kerr. Yeah, not Bob Marley. That was, I think, that was a different kind of collaboration. But but Bob Kerr was part of the Bonzo Dog Doodah band, along with Neil Innes and people like that, and so Bob Kerr spun off and did his own band called the Bob Kerr Whoopee Band, and they're still going, and incredibly we managed to persuade them to come here to Volda to do a concert. And actually they did a concert at Rocken, which was amazing to see, because these guys are all in their sort of 60s and 70s, and Rocken, for anybody who doesn't know listening to this this cast, Rocken is the student venue here in Volda,
have one in Oslo too called same name.
Say again.
We have a similar bar in Oslo called Rocken.
Ah, okay, right. Well, this one is obviously it's connected to the school because it's run by and for the students. So we had this fantastic group of utterly eccentric old Englishman putting on this really insane, very, very funny musical show. Lots of costume changes and lots of stupid noises and lots of silly voices being put on. And the audience just loved it. They just found it so funny. And then we got Bob and the band to do a little mini concert down at the Norwegian Animation Centre to sort of celebrate the opening of the exhibition, and it was very successful. People really loved the exhibition that we did there. So we've had all these very cool exhibitions running at the Animation Centre, and coming into December, we decided that we wanted to do some December events in the run-up to Christmas. And so
you called up your old friend Darth Vader, right?
We did, yeah. Actually, we did. So the one that I ran was last Saturday, and it was it's still running down there now. But the actual event on the day was it's an exhibition of Star Wars memorabilia. And it's all stuff from my collection. You know, I was an instant Star Wars addict in 1977. I bought my ticket from Time Out magazine something like 6 months before the film opened in London.
How did you know it was going to be such a big
deal?
Well,
because the film Star Wars opened in the States on May the 21st of 1977, as was the practice back in those days. Films had staggered opening schedules around the world, much more than they do now.
In Norway, I think the premiere was a couple of years later, even.
Okay,
like 1 or 2 years later.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible. But that was nothing unusual back in those days. You know, it would take films a long time to go around the world. And so I'd already heard about Star Wars even while it was in production. I used to read Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine and Starlog magazine, and there was no internet back in those days, so you purely relied on these little...
How old were you then?
I was 13 in 1977. Yeah. So I was.
Had you seen like older, like The Andromeda Strain or
THX? Oh yeah, sure.
Or,
I was a
movies?
Growing up. I was a complete sort of film and movie comic book.
You're still growing up.
I was a geek. I was a geek before they had geeks. Yeah, and I still am, absolutely. But you know, so I was into all this stuff. I loved all the Planet of the Apes movies, and you know, I saw most of those at the cinema, if not when they came out, but not long after, in sort of second runs and double bills and things like that.
2001 Space Odyssey.
I never actually saw that at the cinema until much later.
That was 68.
68,
right?
Yeah, exactly. But I was born in 64, so I was
going.
You could have
seen it technically.
Technically, I could have seen it. I was certainly I was going to the cinema from the age of about 4 or 5 onwards. I was a very young cinema goer. My mum and dad were both avid cinema goers, and most of my family were cinema goers. And actually, my granddad used to take me and my brother to the cinema almost weekly to go and see double bills. We'd see bizarre double bills like one of the Godzilla movies, one of the late 60s, 70s Godzilla movies, with a film called The Bellstone Fox. I don't know if you do you remember The
it
Bellstone
rings a bell.
Fox,
Will? I don't think I've seen it.
It's a late 60s live action film about this fox. It's kind of a live action Disney movie kind of thing, but it's a real British classic movie that is shown or used to be shown on TV all the time. But cinemas used to have these bizarre double bills. I remember going to see Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze, on a double bill with Richard Lester's Robin Marion. You just couldn't, you couldn't make this shit up if you tried.
It was just blind picking,
just bizarre stuff. But my granddad used to take me like almost every week to the cinema, and it was always, he used to take me to see the Harryhausen movies, you know, all the Jason and the Argonauts and the Sinbad movies, and so I grew up with this stuff in my DNA pretty much, really. And so when Star Wars came along, it really had an effect on me in a lot of different ways. I mean, first of all, because it's a great movie, you know, it blew me away. And I was there on opening night in the UK. I went on December the 27th, 1977, at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Is that sort of the day for, like, the first day it was shown? Or?
It was. It was the very first showing of it. And, and I, as I say, I'd booked my ticket about 6 months in advance. And it really did have an effect on me. I remember just sitting there and watching these incredible effects and this amazing storytelling. And just sitting there and thinking, yep, okay, that's what I want to do. Really? You know, I didn't know exactly what, but I was creative, and I knew that I wanted to go into the creative industry in some way. But I watched Star Wars and I said, I would like to do something with my creativity that affects other people in the way that this is affecting me. It was a very, it sounds like a weird thought for a 13-year-old to have, but I remember just sitting there and it solidified everything that had been building up in me. And I just went, man, this is it. You know, this is what I want to do, because I recognized it both on a, you know, obviously it swept me up in the store in terms of the storyline. It's a grand mythic fairy tale adventure. But also from a filmmaking point of view, from a craft point of view, I was blown away with, you know, until Star Wars, we were living with, if you were a science fiction fan, you were watching films like Logan's Run that had come out the year before. And Logan's Run, I mean, I love it on a kitsch.
It's not that bad.
No, no, like it's, you know, it's a very enjoyable film. But if
Barbarella,
you look at Logan's
like
Run.
That.
Or Barbarella. You know, these films look like they were filmed in a 1970s shopping center with Farrah Fawcett's hairdresser. You know, on every film. I mean, they're always in silver jumpsuits, and you know, everything's made out of bubble wrap, and there are lava lamps everywhere, and that's just the way sci-fi was. You know, it looked, even the expensive stuff looked kind of cheap, and it already looked dated in 1976, and Star Wars came out, and the design ethic
industrial,
was just.
Wasn't it?
And the special effects were just something else entirely. It's maybe difficult for people going to the, you know, people who watch sci-fi films and TV shows now. It's probably very difficult to understand just how much of an impact Star Wars made. But also culturally, there's a very important thing about Star Wars. Films throughout the early and the mid 1970s, you know, we were coming out of a period of, we were post Watergate, post Vietnam, post JFK. And so films at that time reflected this kind of moral ambiguity. You know, you had films like All the President's Men and Apocalypse Now, which was a year or so later, but still very much a product of that time. You know, the Dirty Harry movies, the Vigilante movies, Death Wish, all of these kind of very dark, morally, you know, it's difficult to get to the moral center of these films, because actually that's what culture was like at that time. We were in a very confused, very dark place. We'd come through the kind of flower power hope of the 60s into this awful dark time culturally, you know, with the Vietnam War and everything else that was going on. And suddenly here comes Lucas with this incredibly romantic, hopeful film that just harked back to everything that he loved as a kid. You know, the Saturday morning matinee films, the serials, Flash Gordon and The Adventures of Robin Hood, and, you know, all of these kind of very grand, romantic, hopeful types of culture. And he just plucked that back into the middle of this very dark time in worldwide culture. And the world, it's probably difficult to imagine, but I, you know, having lived through it, I can tell you that the world just went, wait, what? We can be happy. We can make happy movies and hopeful movies, and we don't have to have villains who are, you know, child molesters, or, you know, we don't have to have heroes that are, you know, killing their mothers or whatever.
I mean, like even the Disney movies were pretty dark at the time.
Absolutely.
70s Disney movie, quite dark, especially the villains.
Yeah, you know, even Disney was feeling it at that point, was feeling the pressure of actually everything that was going on around us in the world. Yeah. And so,
and also the idea of the blockbuster was pretty new. Like,
yes.
Jaws was out a couple of years before.
Just 2 years before, you know.
So this is sort of the second blockbuster ever made, isn't it?
Pretty much. And it really set, I mean, Jaws kind of set the pattern for the summer tentpole movie. In fact, film companies used to release their big blockbuster films at Christmas. That was the blockbuster season, was over Christmas, because they figured that during the summer people wanted to be out in the sunshine and off at the beach, and nobody would go to the cinema during the summertime. Why would you go to the cinema in July or June? And so the big blockbuster films, you know, all used to get released at Christmas.
Yeah, and then, in Norway it's kind of still like that, because
it's a bit
cold, and in the summer we are out.
Absolutely. But that's the way the rest of the world used to do it. And then Jaws came out, and they did this thing with releasing it during the summer, and that was it. From then on, you know, we now have what we see as blockbuster season, which seems to extend more and more each year. You know, it's half the year now. It goes from May through till, you know, September, October kind of thing, easily.
Yeah, and then there's Christmas, and you have all the Christmas movies, so that's sort of the second coming of
the Oscar films.
So I was hooked at Star Wars from day one. I was in the Star Wars fan club, you know, and so I collected a lot of stuff over the years, and I've met a lot of the actors in Star Wars, and so we talked about what we could do as an exhibition here in Boulder, and I said, you know, we could. Because the new Star Wars movie is coming out, tomorrow, actually, we could do an exhibition celebrating Star Wars. And so it's running in the gallery at the moment. It's all my original toys and Marvel comics and full sets of Topps trading cards that I collected, all back
you
in.
You actually had enough stuff laying around in your house to fill an exhibition?
Erlen, I have a loft that is like the final shot of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I have a loft that is just filled with boxes and boxes of stuff. I'm a real collector and a hoarder, and one day I will die, probably in the not too distant future, perhaps after somebody hears this podcast, and I will die or be killed off, and people will go rummaging and discover untold treasures in my loft. I had plenty of Star Wars stuff. I mean, original theatrical posters. I have an original storyboard from the production of Return of the Jedi. I have an animation cell from the 1980s series Droids that Lucasfilm did, because they did two animated series in the 1980s, Droids and Ewoks. And so I have an original cell of C-3PO from the Droid series, and I have signed photos, and it's a really nice little show, actually. And it's been kind of nice for me to see, because most of this stuff is usually kept up in boxes. And so to have it out in glass cases and framed in frames up on the wall, it's kind of cool. You know, I've enjoyed seeing it. And on Saturday, we had Darth Vader appear.
It was Darth Vader.
It was Darth Vader. He's a very busy guy. You know, he has an empire to run.
Especially now.
Yeah, especially now. But we had Darth Vader live, and it was incredible. The gallery was so packed. Kids were just kind of... And for those of you that can't see this, I did a big, wide, open mouth. I mean, they were just staring at this guy. And...
Do the kids even know who he is?
You know what? I was having a conversation about this yesterday. I think now that the main Star Wars characters, they are cultural icons. And they are in the DNA. Kids know even if they call him Dark Vader or something, they know that he's a bad guy and that he's from Star Wars in the same way that they know who Mickey Mouse is, even if they've never seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon.
My son was introduced to it through Lego, and you know, most kids are. So they're well aware of the roles within that universe. And so you know, I met a 5-year-old boy in England a few weeks ago, and he's just getting into Star Wars, and he sat down and watched it. He's got DVDs for his dad for his 40th. And then I said, I was going to get him a little present. I said, what do you want? He said, I really want Darth Vader, and I want several stormtroopers so I can have an army. And so he was aware that he needed that army to play, but.
Yeah, I think these characters are now. They're in the kind of cultural DNA, you know. Kids grow up with them, they're on TV, and like you say, they're in things like Lego, and you know, they're just around now. Kids know who they are. So
I was actually listening to a podcast recently where we were talking about just that kids today, it doesn't really matter if they've seen the movies anymore, but the most important thing is that they know about all this stuff that they have together. Like you go to the kindergarten and you meet all these people your same age, and you talk about all this stuff that you don't really know much about, but it's like, here's my Darth Vader guy, and this is, you know?
It's kind of sweet, you know, I love seeing it. Yeah. I really love seeing it as you know, as somebody who grew up... you know, the kind of stuff that I loved growing up was very much considered outsider stuff, you know, because I didn't love football and I didn't love cricket or rugby or whatever, you know. I was reading Marvel comics and watching Jess Franco movies, you know. I knew who Jess Franco was from the age of about 7 or 8 onwards. I mean, that's pretty outsider stuff. And so
not only did this kind of define your career, but also postponed not getting laid for the next like 12 years.
It actually helped, because I was kind of the kind of stuff that I loved, you know. There was a lot of forbidden fruit stuff that I really loved, and so it kind of made girls were kind of interested that I, you know, I had access to The Exorcist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and maybe it was a particular type of girl, but it was a girl nevertheless, you know.
It's the kind of girl you wanted.
you know, I wasn't complaining. But it's great to see this stuff, you know, now in the mainstream. It's great to see that kids just play with Darth Vader and, you know, they have their Star Wars Lego, and they're not kind of ostracized for... You know, being in geek culture is so much more ingrained into the mainstream now, and becoming increasingly so. It's kind of I kind of like seeing that. I'm happy to see, you know, if I see a kid reading a Marvel comic or you know, playing with a Star Wars figure, I'm happy to see that stuff.
Yeah, and we're going to go to Comic Con, Comic Con with my son. We're looking to go because he's desperate to go dressed up as whoever he wants to go as. So I think something from Minecraft. But you know, he's desperate to go and dress up.
Yeah.
And you get to wear your Princess Leia costume again.
Is it the slave?
Yeah. But the knickers are worn out.
I would pay vast amounts of money to see you dressed as Princess Leia's slave girl's outfit, with the glasses and the beard as well. You know, it would do all kinds of wrong things to me.
But it's such a great thing that kids today actually get to be geeks and geek out on stuff, because that's very important to be like super interested in one thing. And you can, we can't all be animators and creative people, but
there are other ways of expressing that creativity, you know. Just like, I mean, like Will's little boy, you know, who wants to dress up as a Minecraft character. I mean, that is expressing a kind of creativity, you know. I want to do this costume. I want, you know, people to see what I'm wearing. It's I love that kind of stuff. It's really
luckily for Will, it's the easiest costume to make.
My daughter's made Slungbox. That's her costume. She's got this great mask that she made.
Fantastic. That's not too bad either. how are you in arts and crafts class, Will?
I did all right. I did all right.
You did all right? Okay, that's good. What's your Star Wars movie? What's like your favorite? Because I if you saw the first movie. I imagine the first movie you saw was as your favorite.
I guess emotionally, it's Star Wars, which I refuse to call A New Hope. Just Star Wars. That's
for
it.
Political reasons.
That came later, didn't it?
It came on the first re-release, I think. It was pretty early, actually. It wasn't that long. I saw it. I kid you not. In the first summer, I saw it about 25 times at the cinema.
Wow.
That's how it affected me.
25?
Yes. Yeah.
Really?
Now, I should clarify that a little. In the olden days, back in the old days, it was perfectly possible to go to the cinema once, pay to go to the cinema, and just sit there all day long.
And you
didn't get chucked out. And so myself and several mates, I do remember during that summer that Star Wars, that it was never off. I mean, that's another thing, you know, now films, they come out to they turn up at your local cinema and they're gone a week later. Back in these days, this was all pre-digital, pre-internet. Films would run for much, much longer, and Star Wars was everywhere for that entire summer. And so myself and several friends would go in and we'd take packed lunches with us. And we would
did they screen more than two films a day or two screens?
Oh yeah, you'd have like I guess you'd have like six showings a day, something like that. Five or six showings a day. It would start at about 11 or 12 in the morning, and then the last screening would be like sort of 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And you could, at certain cinemas, you could, in theory, just sit there all day long on the one ticket, and they wouldn't throw you out. And so myself and mates definitely did that a few times. But, I saw it certainly more than 25 times in the first summer. So from where I saw it first at Christmas, it was still running during the summer holidays. And during that period, I saw it more than 25 times. It seriously had an effect on me, and and was like nothing I'd ever seen before. So
that's your favorite?
Well, I was going to say emotionally, I guess it's Star Wars, but from a filmmaking point of view, I love Empire.
Yeah.
Well, Jed,
yeah. It's simply a better film in many ways.
Yeah.
And the third one, I think, is lacking a few of the. It doesn't really have the excitement that the first two films had.
But Jedi has this. It's an incredibly brave film. The fact that Lucas did this thing of. And I won't sort of go into spoilers here for anybody who and how can you not have, but for anyone who has never seen these films, it's a very inconclusive movie, Empire. Yep. It does not wrap things up. And this was in the days when you would have to wait 2 years to see the next movie, 2 to 3 years. And there is a cliffhanger that is, it's the most famous cliffhanger in the Star Wars universe, involving two of the characters. And it was amazing, because you would just come out of this film, and as I remember doing, sort of discussing whether it was true or not, the relationship between these characters. And you weren't going to see this in, even with the Lord of the Rings films were a year apart. But this was like two or 3 years away. And I just remember everybody going insane with it. And I think that was an incredibly brave thing to do at the time. And it's a very dark movie as well. It's much darker than Empire, and it's more adult. Irving Kirshner was a fantastic director, and really knew how to bring the best out in these characters. Because let's face it, these, you know, the Star Wars characters, it's not Ingmar Bergman. You know, these are not deep, deep, deep characters.
Yeah, it's pretty black and white.
It is pretty black and white, but Kirshner found a way with the actors that gave them great shades of grey in between the black and white, and made them feel more adult, even with the kind of, you know, the little emotional life that they're given throughout, even Empire. He managed to find a way to make it feel a little more adult, a little more connectable. And he was just, obviously, he was just a great director with actors, and it showed in Empire, much more so than I think. I don't know what the deal was with Jedi, with Return of the Jedi, whether Marquand, because Marquand, Richard Marquand, who directed it, made some good movies, but I wonder how much Lucas was. I wonder if Lucas had more of a say over Marquand than he did over Kirshner, because there are some line readings in Jedi, particularly from Harrison Ford, who's allowed to do his kind of what kind of thing. There's a shtick that Ford is allowed to get away with in Jedi that I think Kirshner would have reined in as a director.
But was Kirshner Lucas's teacher or something?
A mentor, I think, if I remember rightly. Okay. Yeah, and I think maybe he'd done some... I think maybe Lucas had done some classes with him at University of Southern California? I think so.
Yeah. So that would make sense then that he had more respect for him because he was his mentor.
Yeah. And also it's interesting. I'm currently reading those huge the making of books. I don't know if you've seen those big hardback books. They've done one for each of the three original trilogy movies, and man, they make for fascinating reading because they really go into not just the making of the films, but actually how Lucasfilm was set up and how ILM was set up.
Oh,
and the kind of the jockeying on Empire was astonishing to read. Lucas, I mean, for all the faults that he might have, he was a brave son of a bitch on Empire. He risked everything because he had made so much money off of Star Wars, and he risked everything to make Empire and to make it a better film. And there are backroom goings on that you read about in this making of book that just make your hair stand on end. You wonder how the guy could sleep at night. You know, that he was setting all these things up, and Fox were, you know, the thing about Star Wars is while Lucas was making Star Wars, nobody believed in the film at all. Everybody, even at Fox, everybody just said, yeah, this film is just going to come out and it's going to die. You know, who's going to go and see this, what, Jawas and robots and
they weren't prepared to make a second and third movie.
No, not at all. And this was the incredible thing about it, is that while Lucas was, during Star Wars, Lucas was jockeying to put more money into the production and agreed to put more of his own money in. But in order to do that, he said to Fox, okay, if I do this, what I want from this deal is I want the sequel rights. And I want the merchandise rights. And of course, Fox just thought that this film would die a death. And so they said, yeah, whatever. Take the merchandise rights. Take the sequel rights. You know, we're never going to make a sequel to this film. And of course, it became, you know, the most successful movie of all time. And so then actually for both Empire and Jedi, Fox had to renegotiate their deal with Lucas. But Empire went hugely over production time and over schedule and over budget, and Lucas was on this constant knife edge where he was trying to get more money from the banks, and it really looked like at one point he would lose all of that control that he'd garnered during Star Wars. But the problem was during Empire was when he'd really begun to build up ILM as a company and Lucasfilm as a company, and Sprocket Sound System, you know, and the Skywalker Ranch, and all of these things were on an absolute thread as to whether he would actually get Empire finished on time and, you know, within some kind of budget. And
it
so
had to be a great movie.
It turned into a great movie, and, you know, and Lucas was a very ballsy filmmaker for doing what he did on that film. So whatever he did with the prequels, you know, you should read these incredible making of books. They really do make for fascinating reading.
What are they called? The books?
They're just called The Making of Star Wars, The Making of Empire Strikes Back, and The Making of Jedi. I'm going to try.
There must be a million books named just that.
Actually, there aren't. Let me just. I'll tell you the name of the author. I'm actually going to bring it up as we're talking.
I want to put a link to that in our show notes.
It's a guy called J.W. Rinzler who wrote the books. And they look like kind of, they're big hardback like art books is what they look like. And they're very, you know, to hold them, they're very heavy to read. And they're full of great sort of behind the scenes shots, making of stuff, and, you know, beautiful design work and concept art. And mixed in with all this is both archival and contemporary interviews with everybody involved in the making of the films. So they're kind of the definitive making of books for the three films.
I am going to read that.
Yeah, highly recommended.
Cool. Should we call it a day?
Yeah.
We have to talk more about all this stuff later, because you have so many stories. we barely get to get a word in, but that's because you have so much to tell.
I know. That's, you know, that's the thing with me. You pay your money and you sit there and listen to me. Sorry.
Yeah. How do you want me? How do you want that wire transferred? Or where do you want your...
I just want the photo of Will in the slave girl Leah costume. God. That's it.
That can be arranged. I think I have something later on from the Animation Festival when you first saw it.
Fantastic. Well, it's been brilliant talking to you guys again for this. It's been always a pleasure, never a chore.
So much fun. What do you want to talk about next time?
Let's talk about me losing hair and putting on weight over 5 years. We didn't really touch on that at all, did we?
We figured out why.
You really want to talk about that?
You know me, I'll talk about anything. Just wind me up and let me go, you know.
But next time we'll have a couple of shots of tequila before we start, and then a couple more while we talk, and we'll see how it turns out.
Fantastic.
We don't really need to prepare anymore. We have this guy on every time. It's perfect.
I could just go to bed.
Yeah.
It's like a bedtime story, you know.
But I'm going to get those. I'm going to get those books.
But
I'm going to get those books. I want to read
Those. Yeah. Highly recommend. Yeah. Yeah.
And we need to have a four-way next time with Martin. That would be fun.
I can't wait to have a four-way with you guys. I've been waiting to have a four-way with you guys since that room in that hotel room in Frederikstadt.
Yeah, wasn't that a four-way?
That was, you know, once you've gone four, you never go back, you know.
Yeah, exactly. No. Yeah, it's been great to talk to you, and hopefully we will have you on more than a couple of times.
Cool.
Later, if you have the time in your busy schedule.
Sure thing. It's always a pleasure.
Cool. Okay.
Thanks for calling
tonight. See you next time.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.